Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas, and Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for, well, an intelligence briefing on what I think of as the war for the free world. A man who has served with great distinction over decades in that war, in the United States Air Force, in the civilian ranks at the highest levels, including as President Reagan's science advisor, also as a deputy director of the organization known as NASA, and in his post-government career in a variety of capacities, including in the private sector at National Security Research, Inc., and on various government advisory boards, is our first guest. He is Dr. William Graham, a man I'm proud to call a friend of many years and delighted to welcome to the show as a guest. Bill Graham, great to have you with us.
Thank you, Frank.
You have recently expressed some concern about a policy that is apparently being considered by the Obama administration at the moment, which would be to eliminate the last stocks in U.S. custody of the virulent disease known as smallpox. Talk about what's at issue there, Bill, and whether the administration should, in fact, eliminate this last element. And I guess it's not just of our stocks, but of the free world's.
The proposal to eliminate our stocks in the free world, and of course the Russians say they will then eliminate their stocks too, but nothing that either the Soviet Union or Vladimir Putin has said about arms control, security, and related matters has proven to be true yet. And I think it would take a great deal of hope over experience to believe that Russia would eliminate its stocks of the smallpox virus that it retains under its control.
We have reason to believe that not just samples of this deadly stuff are in the hands of the former Soviet arsenal, but that they may actually have weaponized versions of this as well. Is that your judgment? And does that make all the more important the retention by us of these stocks for the purposes of understanding such threats and hopefully preparing to contend with them?
Yes. Suppression of the smallpox virus was a great triumph of public health. Unfortunately, it was not a great triumph of national security when we decided to stop vaccinating people and only maintain these two stockpiles, one in the hands of the Russians and one in our hands. And what we found when I chaired President Reagan's General Advisory Committee on Arms Control, was that after the Biological Weapons Convention was signed with the Soviet Union, I believe 72, we immediately destroyed our biological weapons stockpiles, and the Russians immediately began building up their biological weapons stockpiles and developing new biological weapons, which they retained through the end of the Cold War. And we have reason to suspect they have continued to retain to some extent since the end of the Cold War.
Yeah, and may even have been modernizing. And Dr. Graham, you're a serious science guy. Talk a little bit about what may be happening elsewhere around the world in places that aren't supposed to have any of these things, but may have developed them through genetic synthesis or other modifications into even more virulent weapons than old-fashioned smallpox.
Well, there are two points. One is that even though there are no animal reservoirs of smallpox that we know of to recover the virus from, there are places in the world where the smallpox vaccine are still viable and can be found with a sufficient amount of effort. I don't want to go into any more detail than that for obvious reasons. But the second thing is we now know how to genetically modify viruses to give them somewhat different characteristics. The virus that's best understood are the smallpox strains. We know it's extremely contagious, very deadly, and we know how to propagate it, and other countries do as well. But they could be changed as well, and we need to understand how it might be modified to become another kind of biological weapons threat.
This is a whole topic for a much longer conversation, and I hope you'll indulge us on it, Dr. William Graham, because I think that we have really neglected the threat of biological warfare, as it is almost certainly continuing to evolve in not just the hands of the Russians, but perhaps the Chinese and the Iranians and heavens knows who all else. Let me switch gears, if I may, for a moment, because I want to take advantage of your expertise on two other matters. Bill Graham, you chaired the Congressional Blue Ribbon Commission on the Electromagnetic Pulse Threat, or EMP threat. How serious a problem do you believe we face at the moment with respect to the vulnerability of our electric grid against not just EMP, but even prosaic sorts of attacks like that that happened near San Jose a year ago, and perhaps from the sun?
Well, unfortunately, the U.S. And other highly industrialized countries are still extremely vulnerable to that kind of attack. And it's an attack which takes amazingly few resources to carry out on the U.S. It's the kind of attack North Korea, or arguably Iran, could launch against us. Certainly countries with the nuclear weapons capability of Pakistan, China, or Russia could do it. And the administration, and for that matter, the intelligence community, seems to be taking the attitude that since it hasn't happened yet, it won't ever happen, and therefore we can safely annoy it. That's true most days of the week, and even the month. But if it were to happen, the results would be horrific, and therefore there are steps we can take to begin to protect the grid from that, from EMP attack, from cyber attack, from physical attack. As one of the few types of low-resource, high-effect assault that can be made on the United States.
And, of course, this other problem that, irrespective of whether any of those things eventuate, the solar storms that happen roughly every 150 years will afflict us with something akin to this. And you've estimated publicly, Dr. Graham, that if one or the other of these things actually does occur and takes down the electric grid of the United States over large areas for a long period of time, as up to a year or more, perhaps as many as 9 out of 10 of us might die. Is that correct?
That's correct. And Mother Nature, as you point out, also has her form of electromagnetic pulse attack. It's different in detail, but the effects were much the same. And it has happened several times in the recorded past, roughly every 150 years, but it's a somewhat statistically occurring phenomenon. And what we did say we would take the country back to about its carrying capacity of the days before the distribution of electricity, and that was best something like 10% of the current population, which would be more like 30 million than 300 million.
Bill Graham, I just want to swing to one more issue. As I mentioned, you were deputy director of NASA back under President Reagan. One of the things that I'm very anxious about is the prospect that we will be denied access to space, manned access most especially to space, as a result of policies that have been pursued under successive administrations, but particularly this one, that has allowed our industrial base to attrit and the shuttle to be dispensed with and so on. How serious a problem is it that the Deputy Prime Minister of Russia has said that if the United States wants to send men to this international space station, our international space station, henceforth, they can use a trampoline to get them there?
Well, the astronauts are pretty agile physically, but I've never seen one get much above 40 or 50 feet on a trampoline, and that's doing pretty well. So I suspect that approach isn't going to work. The U.S., very unwisely in my view, became wholly dependent on Russia for the RD-180 engine, which is a primary engine we use in several of our space launch vehicles. We had the opportunity at one point to co-produce that ourselves, but out of the argument of saving a small amount of money and with the assumption that we could certainly trust the Russians to support us if we paid them enough money for it, the U.S. decided not to develop its own production capability of the RD-180. In my view, the results of that have been roughly the same as the results of night following day. The Russians are now trying to use it has a sword over our head and telling us that we can't use that for national security launches, and they may not let us use it at all. We have some of those engines in inventory at the moment, so the effect won't be instantaneous, but it would take a heroic effort to develop that capability in the time we have left before we run out of the inventory we have on hand.
A frightening further prospect for us to consider, as have been the other two topics we've addressed with you. Bill Graham, I just can't tell you how much I appreciate all that you've done for our country and the kind of warnings and the clarity vision that you bring to the topics we have been discussing today. Come back to us again very soon, if you would. And in the meantime, stay well. Next up, we will talk with Charlotte Florence about Boko Haram.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
There's a reason Bill Bennett doesn't go after people that disagree with him.
I don't think you persuade people when you yell at them,
when you make fun of them,
when you wave your finger and scold them. I don't think you turn anybody around.
And I think the reason that you try to adopt the Socratic maxims of
candor, intelligence, and goodwill
is because people can change their minds.
They're not going to change their minds if you call them idiots.
I just don't think so.
Bill Bennett's Morning in America. Weekday mornings from 6 to 9 on 1260 WRC. New choice. Intelligent talk.
Are you looking to hire an IT specialist or a logistics expert, a medical technician, or a security professional? Well, there are some very qualified candidates out there. America's wounded warriors. These men and women returning from battle are eager to get back to life at home and a good job. Some have wounds you can see, and some have wounds you can't see, like post-traumatic stress disorder. For these accomplished professionals, Wounded Warrior Project has developed the Warriors to Work program, a career counseling service that helps wounded warriors translate their military experience to the civilian workplace. These warriors have world-class job skills and a unique perspective on teamwork. And to ensure proper placement for each individual, Wounded Warrior Project works with employers to find just the right candidate for the job. When your company is looking to hire talented, highly trained employees, contact Wounded Warrior Project at findwwp.org. Welcome home the brave.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the War of Ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
Michael Medved says stupidity in our federal government is a bipartisan issue.
This administration and the leadership of Barack Obama
and the leadership of some folks in the Republican Party
are both so stupid and just so inane and brain dead. Can you see some kind of bright side here?
Stupid is, stupid does, sir.
The Michael Medved Show.
You want to help me with this?
Afternoons from 3 to 6 on 1260 WRC. New choice. Intelligent talk.
Ready to roll?
Go for it.
Hi, I'm Jessie Jane Duff. I'm a retired United States Marine Corps Gunnery Sergeant, and I served 20 years on active duty serving this great country. I'm with Concerned Veterans for America now. After I got off active duty, I realized I still wanted to be involved and help change the direction our country is going. Concerned Veterans for America offered me that great opportunity. If you want to get involved and you're thinking of getting involved, please visit our website because we have many activities throughout the nation. We have wonderful representatives in each state who are putting forward different ways you can become engaged. So go to the website at concernedveteransforamerica.org, and you do not have to be a veteran. But if you support the freedoms that we all fought so hard for to defend this great nation, then consider participating in the many activities we are participating in and helping to change the direction our country is going.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We're joined by Charlotte Florence. She is a research associate for economic freedom in Africa and the Middle East at the highly regarded Heritage Foundation. She's proficient in this region of the world and wonderful guest here for us at Secure Freedom Radio. Always glad to have her with us. Welcome back, Charlotte.
Thank you.
Let's start with Boko Haram. You've been trying to educate the rest of us about who these characters are. They've, of course, leapt to the public consciousness because of their recent horrific ravages in Nigeria, notably the seizure of some 200 young women. But what are they about, and what does this mean for not just Nigeria, but perhaps for other countries in the region as well, that they're on the loose?
Yeah, and I think that Boko Haram is something that northern Nigeria has been, you know, in a relatively deep conflict for the past 5 years. The group that was even started didn't become as violent as it is now, but it was started as early as 2002. And you've had, I think, you know, because by the nature of how the country is divided, you have a Muslim North, predominantly Muslim North, predominantly Christian South. And so there has been a lot of building grievances, and a lot of it comes from colonial administration and how, you know, certain people perceive things in a certain way. And it has, I think, really helped to aid Boko Haram's ability to operate in the area, unlike other terrorist groups, terrorist insurgents like Al-Shabaab in Somalia or even the Taliban in Afghanistan. Boko Haram doesn't actually provide social services, or they don't even really have to build support in some of the places that they operate in. It's just terror, and these populations distrust the government of Nigeria so much that they're willing to support Boko Haram. So I think that kind of highlights that this is a very complicated situation, and the government of Nigeria has not been able to adequately address it for the past, I think, 2 years. They've put a sustained effort on it.
We're visiting with Charlotte Florence of the Heritage Foundation. She formerly served on the staff of Senator Scott Brown and is deeply knowledgeable about Africa. And Charlotte, you were just saying that Boko Haram is fundamentally an Islamist operation and terroristic in character. The government of Nigeria has not been up to the task of countering it, particularly in the northern parts of the country that are deeply skeptical about that government. Is that likely to improve prospects for the Nigerian government, that is, most especially with respect to freeing these girls, with U.S. and other Western powers' assistance, in your judgment?
Yeah, I think that this has built, unfortunately, I don't think the Nigerian government has really taken advantage of the situation in the way that they should have in terms of building, you know, societal support in northern Nigeria, given their, I think, just, it was seen as though they weren't really doing anything. And I don't think that they're trained or they have the capacity to really operate within communities and do it in a way that they're not going to harm civilians. And of course, problems with terrorists is that they are more than happy to harm civilians. So it's obviously an asymmetric task, but at the same time, I think the Nigerian military has serious challenges that even prohibit, you know, U.S. forces from directly partnering with them because of human rights allegations. So I think our ability to actually partner with the Nigerians and for the Nigerians to actually want us to partner with them is still very much in the air. I think this has been the advisors that we sent, I think, was a very small, you know, drop in this very big bucket. So I think that there's going to have to be some more recognition on the part of the Nigerian government and the military that this is something so much larger than just Nigeria. And the fact that Boko Haram operates in Cameroon and they recruit from Niger and they get arms from Chad, training camps in northern Mali, as you remember from the French discovering, you know, caravans of Boko Haram troops heading back to northern Nigeria. So it's a regional, a really big regional problem.
Yeah. And this is really a critically important point, Charlotte Florence, and that is that we're watching in country after country, it would seem, this spread of kind of a Sharia-adherent Islam that is promoting and enabling and in other ways supporting these kinds of jihadist operations. Clearly, as you say, a problem for a country like Nigeria, which has got its own rather considerable difficulties, not least of which is its military is really deficient in many respects, it appears. But so many of these other countries, talk a little bit about what's been going on in some of them, in Cameroon, for example, and in Sudan, where we've seen evidence of these guys at work as well.
Yeah, I think Cameroon is a perfect example. Just over the weekend, it's still not fully confirmed, but the Boko Haram is alleged to have kidnapped, I think it's around 10 Chinese migrant workers. So I think it gets to the point that this is not a group that just wants to target Nigeria, that they have international aims, and they're looking to get onto the radar for a variety of very violent activities.
For the purpose of securing through negotiations independence or sovereignty over parts of the region? Or what is their aim strategically, in your judgment?
Yeah, I think that's the starting point, and it only gets bigger from that point. So I think that's why you've seen, while they claim that they're going to sell the girls into human trafficking, and who knows if they have sold some of them into that horrible trade, I think that their big aim is to get, you know, leaders that are in jail, supporters that are imprisoned. So I think that they would really like a hostage exchange, because they're able to find financing and through other illicit activities. So I don't think, I mean, the sale, for as low as some of the reports have been on the girls, that's not a huge monetary gain. I think it's a bigger gain for them to get these troops back. It's believed that the Nigerian government has done this in the past. Even with the French citizens that were kidnapped by Ansaru, a Boko Haram break-off organization, it's believed that they were paid off or there was some sort of exchange.
Sounds right, that's for sure. Talk about the apprehension by Interpol in Sudan of an individual associated with some of this terrorist activity in Abuja.
Yeah, so this is, I think, an example of a foreign fighter supporting Boko Haram. He was a British citizen, also served in the Nigerian military, so has, you know, training, understands logistics and warfare. And he was, it's alleged that he was involved in the Abuja bombing that was about 2 weeks ago. It was a big car bomb that went off in a main market square in the capital of Nigeria. And he fled to Sudan. It's believed that he was picked up. I don't know if it's been confirmed, but there was an Interpol arrest warrant out for him. So I think this again highlights the international aspect of this organization. It's not just a local insurgent.
And Charlotte Florence of the Heritage Foundation, lastly, the Sudan is, of course, a place that is a hotbed of this Islamist activity itself. It's rather remarkable that they would allow an operative with that same shared goal to be apprehended. Talk also, if you would, about the plight of this young woman, Maryam Ibrahim, at the hands of the Sudanese government.
Yeah, I think that her story speaks to really the brutality of Sharia law and how you can manipulate, I think, certain aspects of religious law to really be just detrimental to a judicial system and overall. But the fact that, you know, her son is in jail with her and that she's going to be executed after she has her, you know, I believe she's like 8 months pregnant right now, just for being a Christian, which I think, you know, her mother was a Christian. It's not like she converted to this. It's what she grew up as. So,
but it's apostasy and adultery. And as you say, under Sharia, those are very harshly treated, as are most other things, it turns out. Charlotte, we have to leave it at that for the moment. Thank you very much. And your work at the Heritage Foundation is deeply appreciated. I hope you'll keep us apprised of developments in Africa. It's a very important part of the world, and we all need to be paying more attention to it, particularly for the reasons we've just discussed. Thank you. Keep it up. Come back to us again soon. Andy McCarthy joins us next. We'll talk about another aspect of this Sharia agenda, repression of freedom of speech. But is the IRS doing it too? Right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
Hugh Hewitt keeps the Constitution first.
That's what the left is about right now. Not about this or that.
Regulation or restriction.
Not about keeping weapons out of the hands of the mentally disabled. It's about attacking the Constitution. And by the way, you cannot mess with the Second Amendment without messing with the First and the Fourth and the Fifth and the Tenth. You either respect the Constitution or you don't.
The Hugh Hewitt Show. Weeknights at 6 after Michael Medved at 3 on 1260 WRC. New Choice. Intelligent Talk.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. For the past 5 years, the Obama administration has engaged in what can only be called a wrecking operation against the U.S. military. It has cut the resources available to equip and train the troops and fired many top warriors. And it is engaged in demoralizing and disruptive social engineering by allowing homosexuals and perhaps transgender individuals to serve and clearing women for frontline combat positions. Now the White House wants the Pentagon to say it's, quote, vital to national security, unquote, to open the ranks to illegal aliens. Taken together, such steps risk breaking the all-volunteer force. Enemies of the United States are watching these developments closely. They can only be emboldened and war made more likely if they perceive our military as no longer a deterrent to their aggressive designs. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Learn more at securefreedom.org.
The Devil We Don't Know by Noni Darwish uncovers the dark side of revolution in the Middle East and the reason why Muslim countries are unable to dig themselves out of a cycle of revolution, political unrest, and tyranny. The constitutions of many Muslim countries state that Sharia law supersedes all other law, and that is why it has failed in providing a legal and political system where healthy democracy can flourish. In this dynamic, only tyrannical governments can survive. In The Devil We Don't Know, human rights activist and Center for Security Policy fellow Noni Darwish answers the tough questions. Why the Arab Spring won't usher in freedom and democracy or a feminist movement. And how Israel will be threatened by the new wave of Islamism after the so-called Arab Spring. The Devil We Don't Know by Noni Darwish. It's available at Amazon.com.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.
Every day, the men and women of the United States Marine Corps demonstrate their commitment to defend the American way of life. Since 1775, wherever the mission takes us, we always remember the land we call home. As Marines, we take a stand for our nation, for us all. The few, the proud, the Marines.
Hi, this is Frank Affney. You're listening to Intelligent Talk on WRC 1260 in Washington, D.C.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Well, the highlight of our week has arrived. It is our visit with Andy McCarthy, the former federal prosecutor turned pundit and savant, really, on matters involving national security, especially national security and the law. He is the author of several best-selling books and one that is sure to be in that category upcoming, entitled Faithless Execution, making the case for the impeachment of Barack Obama. He is a man who has, I believe, contributed mightily, both in government service and in the years since, and I put right up at the top of his contributions our weekly visits. It's always good to have you with us, Andy. Welcome back.
Frank, thank you so much. I appreciate that.
Let's visit first about something that you've written this week in National Review Online. It is an interesting account of what the internal repression service, as you call it, has become with respect to freedom of speech. Talk a little bit about your insights on that.
Well, I think what we're finding now, Frank, I started off the column this weekend with a reference to the sage old philosopher Yogi Berra, that it's deja vu all over again, because it seems that only days after Judicial Watch managed to get where no congressional committee has gone before, namely some long sought after evidence in connection with the Benghazi scandal, the very same thing happens with respect to the IRS, where it's now true. It's now obvious what I think we've strongly suspected all along, that the strings on the IRS harassment of conservative groups, the tip of the spear of which was this Cincinnati office that dealt with what they call exempt organizations, was actually the strings were being pulled in Washington, and I think that's always been obvious, but now it's clear from emails that Tom Vitton at Judicial Watch was able to uncover. And I think what they show is that it was a coordinated effort in Washington to use one of the most fearsome bureaucracies in government, our revenue collecting agency, the IRS, as a tool to stop conservative groups from organizing and being an effective force for pushing on issues in the run-up to the 2012 re-election campaign of Barack Obama.
Were you struck as much as anything, Andy, by the role and the documentation of the role played by the senior United States Senator from Michigan, Carl Levin, in all of this?
Well, I wasn't surprised at this point, Frank, given what we had heard up until now. And just to give our listeners a little background on this, this all goes back to a Supreme Court case in early 2010 called Citizens United, which reaffirmed the First Amendment political speech rights of groups, including corporations, which was something that the progressive side of the House and the Senate was very whipped up about. People may remember that President Obama was actually audacious enough to lecture the Supreme Court on their decision only days after they rendered it in his State of the Union address. And I think that communicated all across the Beltway what the tenor of enforcement was going to be in the Obama administration, and the fact that they were very hospitable to arguments to try to undo the Citizens United decision, whether they had to do it by bureaucratic action or legislation or whatever means they had. So people like Carl Levin, who's a very powerful Democrat from Michigan in the Senate, obviously felt very comfortable approaching the IRS and demanding that there be action taken against these mainly conservative groups. I think Levin cited 12 groups, 11 of them were conservative groups, to try to stop them from mobilizing. And they just happened to be groups that he was ideologically opposed to and a little fearful of in terms of his electoral prospects.
Yeah, it strikes me as both stunning and scandalous, really, and possibly even criminal. And I don't expect any prosecution of Carl Levin in all of this, needless to say, but it really is an effort to subvert the processes and restrictions on the IRS.
You're quite right about that. I think that, you know, we talk about prosecution because it's very possible that laws were violated here. There actually is a federal criminal statute that involves official action, that is, you know, government employees, government agents taking actions that have the effect of depriving citizens of their constitutional, statutory, or other rights under federal law, and that may very well have happened here. But I think the most important thing, because of the huge political, public policy, and civil rights ramifications of this, is not who gets prosecuted. It's basically uncovering what happened, holding people politically accountable, and removing power from people who've abused their power. Much more important than prosecution.
Well, I agree with you. The case for doing the latter is sometimes more difficult in a political system like ours, which is, of course, the thrust of your new book, which we await with great expectation, Faithless Execution, Building the Case for Obama's Impeachment. We're speaking with Andy McCarthy of National Review Online and Pajamas Media. Andy, let me turn to a related topic. You mentioned Benghazi. One of the issues, of course, in that caper was the default setting for the administration that it was all about offending Muslims that prompted the attack, a video in this case. Talk a little bit, if you would, about the Organization of Islamic Cooperation and the role that it has been playing with help from the Obama administration from its outset in suppressing freedom of speech, not through the IRS in this case, but through, well, as Hillary Clinton famously put it, shaming and peer pressure.
The Obama administration's been working with this outfit, the OIC, which is this conglomeration of 57 Islamic governments, 56 nation states and the Palestinian Authority. And they've been working for really virtually since the Obama administration began, with Hillary Clinton at the forefront of it, involved in something that was known as the Istanbul process, on a UN resolution, a Human Rights Commission resolution that was known as 1618, which had to do with basically imposing Sharia repression principles on international law, which of course would include the United States. So basically you try to slipstream via international law restrictions that would have the effect of short-circuiting American free speech rights. And this would be any time you said anything that would so much as instill hostility to Islam, whatever, or to religion. But we only know that they're only talking about one religion here. The interesting thing of this, about this, I think, Frank, is not only the constitutional aspect of it, but the common sense aspect of it. And this goes back to this whole video charade that they played on the country in connection with Benghazi, that, you know, this whole thing was caused by the video, not by a terrorist attack. If they were right, think about what the logic of their position is. What they're basically saying is that it was a video that caused people to go out and commit mass murder. Now, you know, I've seen a lot of video in my time that I found pretty offensive. I haven't yet been moved to mass murder over any of it, and I doubt that if I were, anybody would say, well, you know, you have to understand, poor Andy was moved by this movie that he saw. So I really think that the underlying theory of the Obama administration's position here is really offensive. It's offensive to, Muslims who are not terrorists and are normal human beings who are not moved to violence over being provoked over something that they see. So we're talking about a radical extremist element of Islam. And again, the culprit here is never a video or anything that any pretextual thing that they claim to be offended about. The culprit is an ideology that says that a provocation against Islam is not only something to turn your nose up at, but something actually to get violent over.
We'll be talking more in coming days about a marvelous film on this subject entitled Silent Conquest, The End of Freedom of Speech in the West by Ann Fishman. I put in a cameo appearance, as do many of the eminences of our time, on these topics. And Andy, I know you'll find it very interesting as well. The books that you have written on this subject, Willful Blindness, The Grand Jihad, and Spring Fever, all are relevant, of course, and remind us of the importance that we attach to our constitutional rights. And I appreciate you standing up for them day in and day out. Andy McCarthy, thank you as always for joining us. We look forward to talking with you again next week. Keep up the terrific work you do. Next up, Claire Lopez joins us to talk about the real war on women right after this.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
An inspector general serves as an independent watchdog in each federal agency, promoting integrity and efficiency while rooting out fraud, waste, and abuse of authority in our government. Several important U.S. agencies have not had an IG for years, including the State Department, which has been without an IG for 5 years. During a constant wave of scandals in Washington, D.C., the newly published IG handbook by yours truly, Joseph E. Schmitz, couldn't be more timely. Every IG takes an oath to support and defend the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic. By exposing fraud, waste, or abuse through audits, IGs satisfy the constitutional mandate that a regular statement and account of the receipts and expenditures of all public money shall be published from time to time. The new IG handbook explains by what authority and for what purpose an inspector general does what he or she does on behalf of we, the people. Find the Inspector General Handbook on Amazon.com.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the War of Ideas, ammo is money. The center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
I'm Robert Muse, co-founder and senior counsel of the American Freedom Law Center, our nation's premier public interest law firm fighting for your faith and freedom in courtrooms across America. Make no mistake, we live in a pivotal time. Secular progressives such as Barack Obama and his surrogates are zealously sweeping religion from the public square, foisting Sharia law and other harmful international precedents into our courts and constitution, assaulting the traditional family, and weakening our national defense by, among other things, undermining the strength of our military through social engineering and political correctness. But I can assure you that the American Freedom Law Center is aggressively engaging our nation's enemies with offensive lawfare to defend our fundamental rights and to fight stealth jihad in all of its forms, including the civilization jihad being waged by Muslim Brotherhood front groups operating here in the U.S. Indeed, there is no other public interest law firm as uniquely qualified to fight this battle. But we need your prayers and financial support to succeed. Please consider a tax-deductible donation to support our critical fight for your faith and freedom. Visit us at www.AmericanFreedomLawCenter.org.
I had no choice the news that was given to me on August 2nd.
Gold Star mom, Debbie Lee.
But I did have a choice how I responded.
In August 2006, Mark Allen Lee became the first Navy SEAL to lose his life in Iraq.
I chose to put on Mark's boots, pick up his weapon, and stay in the fight for our troops and their families.
And America's Mighty Warriors was born.
Mark's name meant Mighty Warrior. And he definitely lived up to his name.
At AmericasMightyWarriors.org, you'll find Mark's last letter home.
Read it, and you'll know what AMW's about.
It's about service to active duty members of the military and their families.
Including care packages, visits, and more.
It's about supporting the wounded and the people who love them.
It's about the Gold Star family.
Special retreats, concerts, Mother's and Father's Day events to let them know they're loved and not forgotten. Donations are tax deductible and go directly where they're needed.
Read Mark's last letter home.
And just as he inspired his mom, let Mark inspire you to some random acts of kindness of your own.
This is Jenny Thomas. I do video interviews of leaders with the Daily Caller. I had the privilege recently of interviewing Diana West about her extraordinary new book, American Betrayal, The Secret Assault on Our Nation's Character. You can see it at dailycaller.com. American Betrayal reads like a spellbinding historical thriller, but it is also a carefully documented account of how the U.S. government was penetrated by communist agents in the years after President Roosevelt normalized relations with the Soviet Union. Diana West shows how a similar assault is being mounted today by yet another collectivist ideology, the supremacist Islamic doctrine of Sharia. She establishes that while the communists and the Islamists may have very different visions of the world, they have employed the same techniques to defeat America. Please watch my conversation with Diana West about American Betrayal, then check out the other great leaders we profile at dailycaller.com.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. We're joined by Claire Lopez. She is, I'm very pleased to say, a colleague at the Center for Security Policy, where she is in charge of research and analysis, our vice president there. She is a career Central Intelligence Agency operations officer with considerable experience in the field and working behind enemy lines. She brings to the subject a deep knowledge, among other things, of Iran and Sharia and how the way of the world is sorting at the moment. And it's always good to have a chance to visit with her. Claire, welcome back.
Thank you, Frank. I'm glad to be with you.
I'd like to sort of get your take on something that I think we're going to be spending a lot of time on under your leadership at the Center for Security Policy, namely what I think of as the real war on women. Talk a little bit, Claire, if you would, about the connective tissue between so many of the things that we're
we're focusing on these days, whether it's girls being hived off by Boko Haram or this poor woman, Mariam Ibrahim in Sudan, or the honor killings that are taking place in the West, including in our own country, female genital mutilation or female castration, as it's been called. What do these things have in common?
Well, I mean, you're right to draw a comparison between all of these, and we're seeing horrific examples of abuse against women in places like Africa. As you mentioned, Mariam Ibrahim, this Sudanese Christian woman facing flogging and death because she will not recant her Christian faith, to Boko Haram kidnapping women and girls who are primarily Christians, holding them for ransom, or perhaps even forcing them to convert, as some news stories would have it. And then looking at what is happening in the West, in Europe certainly, and even in the United States. And the connective tissue, unfortunately, is Islamic doctrine. And because Muhammad, the prophet of Islam, did all of these things. He captured women in battle. He raped them. He sold them into sex slavery. Because he is considered to be the perfect examples, these things, including both slavery and sexual slavery, as well as some of these other practices, heinous as we think they are in the modern day, obviously, because he did them and he is the perfect example, they have not been outlawed in Islam.
Far from being outlawed, they'd in fact being enshrined in Sharia and practiced as the authoritative version of Islam, not by all Muslims, needless to say, but by the authorities of the faith and many in government in places like the ones we've been talking about. Claire, another place where Sharia has reared its ugly head, of course, is in Libya, in part at least thanks to the Obama administration's contributions to overthrowing Muammar Gaddafi and bringing to power there, or at least to considerable degrees of domination, jihadists of the most virulent stripe. You've been serving on the Citizens Committee on Benghazi for some time, and I'd like, you know, your thoughts on how what we're seeing develop there, a select committee to investigate it, to be sure, but also the recent revelations by your own commission and others, how is this tied into this larger Sharia enterprise, as you see it?
Well, I mean, as you say, Frank, Libya is in utter chaos today. It is engulfed in warfare. All sorts of delegations are closing and pulling out again. But our Citizens Commission on Benghazi, yes, has been working for almost a year on trying to get to the bottom of what happened on September 11, 2012, when our mission there was attacked. And we were very pleased to see the appointment a week or a little more ago by Speaker Boehner of a select committee in Congress to investigate. And this means that committee will have subpoena powers. It will be able to compel testimony from witnesses under oath, and I think that's important to get to the bottom of what our own leadership did there in Libya, which essentially was to assist militias aligned with al-Qaeda to overthrow a sovereign government. Dictator, a tyrant though Gaddafi was, he was working with us against al-Qaeda. We allied with al-Qaeda to put him out of office, to kill him, oust him, and now the chaos is the result. So we welcome the committee in Congress. We hope to work with it and get to the bottom of not just what happened before, but the failure to come to the aid of our people when they were there under fire, fighting alone. Not a single finger was lifted to send any military help to them. And then, of course, the cover-up afterwards, the duplicitous use of the narrative about a YouTube video as the cause of non-existent protests in Benghazi as the cause for that attack.
But it really fits into, and this is again where I keep coming back to the Sharia connective tissue, that meme, of course, played directly into the narrative the administration had been promoting from its earliest days in office, that we must conform to what amount to Sharia blasphemy laws, that we mustn't give offense to Muslims. It's part of this so-called Istanbul process that Hillary Clinton helped foster, and hardly surprising, really, especially when they were desperately scrambling to try to come up with some other explanation for what was going on in Benghazi other than the abject failure of American policy. Claire Lopez is our guest. She is a senior vice president at the Center for Security Policy, responsible for research and analysis, longtime Central Intelligence Agency operations officer, also the author of a very, very important paper for the center called The Rise of the Iran Lobby. And Claire, I'd like to turn to Iran with you. We have had in recent days the latest round of negotiations with the Iranians on their so-called nuclear program, what we all know to be a nuclear weapons program. Where do we stand with those negotiations? Is there any prospect, in your judgment, that they're going to actually result in an end to that program, or are the Iranians simply buying time and having their way with us?
Well, it doesn't look like much progress is being made at all. Talks in Vienna ended once again this past week, with no progress made. The American delegates are talking about great difficulty, gaps between the American and the international position and Iran's position. What this goes to is that the international community in the negotiations really does seem to be sticking to its guns about limiting Iran's capability to acquire what might be called a breakout ability, to dash to a nuclear weapon. And they want to limit the number of centrifuges, which would mean that Iran would have to dismantle some of its 19,000 currently installed at two different places. It doesn't want to do that. The negotiators also want to talk about Iran's ballistic missiles, which would, of course, be one of the ways that they could deliver a nuclear warhead. And the missiles aren't even on the table for discussion at this time. So there's huge gaps remaining. They're aiming for a July 20th deadline to reach an agreement. It doesn't look like they're going to make it.
And what happens then, Claire? Do they simply kick the can down the road, extend the negotiations, and continue, presumably, the unraveling of the sanctions and the buying of time for the Iranian program?
Well, I mean, it looks like that has been the pattern up until now. Certainly, it's in the Iranians' best interest to keep the negotiations going, because as long as they do, as you say, the sanctions continue to unravel. I mean, really, that is a done deal. The sanctions cannot be put back together again in any manner that resembles what they were prior to the beginning of these talks. As long as the negotiations go on, Iran also feels a little bit secure from a potential strike, a military strike, let's say, by Israel. And it's in their interest to keep the talks going.
They certainly will, and I'm afraid so will the Obama administration. Claire Lopez, you will be on top of that for us, I'm sure, and thank you for the great work you do at the Center for Security Policy and for your past service to our country, as well as that you continue to render. And we'll look forward to talking with you again very soon. We'll talk with the rest of you, I hope, again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom.